From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Back to Truth and Justice. I am joined today. I have a very special guest. Her name is Melissa Moore. A lot of you have probably already heard of her. She is known for a lot of her work in the media and her advocacy work, but you may know her as the daughter of Keith Jesperson, who was known as the Happy Face Killer. He was convicted for murdering at least 8 women. And you were, Melissa, you were a teenager at the time when you found all this out?
Yeah, 1995. So we're at the 30-year anniversary right now of his arrest. I was, I think, 15. Yeah, 15 years old.
Yeah, so we got to be right about the exact same age then.
I'm going to be 47. Sorry. I'm making myself a year older.
I'm 46. I'm going on 47. Yeah, so we would say, did you graduate in 1997?
98.
So you're 1 year behind me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so... I don't want to spend any time talking about your dad, but I'm more interested anybody can look up anything about him, but like your experience living through this, because you had, from my understanding, you had no idea what was going on. I mean, he was living like a double life. So can you kind of talk a little bit about like what that experience was like? And then we're going to get into what I really want to talk about, which is what you've done with that trauma that you went through.
Yeah. So, I mean, growing up, I thought I had a really, really good childhood. You know, if I compartmentalize the animal abuse out of it, you know, that just put that on a shelf and everything else is pretty normal. He was very much into please and thank yous, teaching us manners, making sure that he wanted us to be good people. So, I mean, it's really incredibly strange that he would try to instill all these great ethics and character traits in all of us 3 kids. I'm the oldest of 3. And then come to learn that he had this double life. As far as when his double life started, there's still questions looming about that, especially with the letter that he wrote to my uncle. So that's ultimately what got him arrested, by the way. So in 1995, about this time, March, he wrote a confession of some sorts letter to my uncle, and my uncle sent it to my grandfather to review it as well. And it said, I call it the black sheep letter. It said, I'm truly the black sheep of the family. I've killed 8 women, assaulted more. And so it's that last sentence, assaulted more, that, you know, what does that mean? How many more victims are there? I believe that there truly are, you know, a core 8 that he's killed. But, as you know, we know that one of his first victims, Dawn, escaped and was sexually assaulted by my father. So I believe he was practicing way before 1990 that we know of. Yeah. So truly how many victims he has, I don't know.
With the core 8, because I followed kind of your life and your media over the years. And, you know, we met, and I think it was we were in Austin at CrimeCon a few years ago, and was just super interested in your story. I'm not, considering I host a true crime podcast, I'm not a true crime buff, and I'm not like into serial killers. So I never study like all these serial killers and the things they've done. Have the 8 victims that he said that he murdered, have they all been identified?
I believe there's one that is still Jane Doe. But mind you, like, even though I don't know how to say this, but I don't follow my father's crimes or his media. There's a level of removal for me in that. It's because there's, you know, there's so much mystery around like the truth of it. Let me see how I could say this. He's lied so much that it's hard to believe what is the truth and what are lies. And so the only thing that I know for truth is when I see it printed in paper from the authorities or, you know, from reputable sources.
Sure. So in 1995, you're what, a freshman, sophomore in high school, and you get this new, a freshman in high school. So did you, Or did you go to a big school? Was it a small school? Like, what was that like? Because I mean, because it was headlines everywhere. And yeah, just like, so, your dad, who you thought was this fine dad, all of a sudden is a serial killer.
I was living in Spokane, Washington, and I was going to Shadle Park High School. And the murder that he was charged for, Julie Winningham, happened here in the Portland, Oregon, Camas, Washington area, because we have the river. So for people who aren't really familiar with this area, the Columbia River separates Washington and Oregon. And so he lived on the Oregon side and would travel across the bridge to the Washington side of the river. So that's where it probably gets confusing with his crimes, is that his first victim we know is Tanya Bennett, which happened on the right side, on Portland side of the river. And then his last victim was Julie Winningham on the other side of the river in Camas, Washington. So he was charged for her murder, Julie Winningham, and went to jail. And that's, I saw him in jail. And that's when he said, "Missy, my best advice is to change your last name." And that's when I knew that he was guilty of the charges. But then we would soon discover through that trial that summer that there were many, many more crimes he was connected to, that he was actually a serial killer. Because at the beginning, he was, you know, a charged man on one count of murder. And then it was serial murder.
So what was it like for you going back to high school?
It was really rough. It was, I mean, at that time, there really wasn't the environment that we have today with true crime. Like, there was, there weren't podcasts. There weren't, I mean, people didn't really talk about true crime other than Unsolved Mysteries was a thing that I would actually watch with my dad. So everything I know about crime was really through the local news. And so that's how I broke, the news broke. And then all of my friends' parents found out about it, and they didn't want their kids to be around me, which I'm a parent now and my kids are grown, but I can understand their fears back then, just because it was such a unique, you know, unique situation.
Yeah. And did you stay in that high school for the rest of your high school?
No, I left. And kind of went, then I went to Mead High School and really tried to just go underground, kept to myself mostly. I had one friend that I hung out with the most. And when she wasn't around, I would go to the library and read books. But I really became pretty much a recluse after that, just trying to hide and, you know, keep out of, I don't know, just keep out of people's way, I guess, because it was so shocking to me. Even I was still trying to wrap my head around it. We didn't have therapy. We didn't have anybody to really talk to. So I internalized a lot of that, you know, myself, I guess.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. And that's one of the things I find so fascinating about your story, is you did what you would expect someone to do, like try to, like, you know, change your name, try to get away from this because you don't want to be, you know, the daughter of the happy face killer. But then 15 years later, you published a book.
Right.
And you put it on. And I don't know if it was that the kind of beginning of your media career. The book is called Shattered Silence, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer's Daughter. And when you put, was that your first kind of like step into media, or had it already happened a bit before that?
It happened a little bit before that. What happened privately is that I was a mom, and my daughter was, I think it was kindergarten, she was learning about families and doing a family tree project. She's filling out the family tree and realized that there's a missing branch, and that was her maternal grandfather. And so she came home asking who this person is, and to help her with that assignment. And that's when I said, "Oh, he's, you know, he lives in Salem," but I didn't say, you know, in the show I say that he's dead, but I said that he lives in Salem, which is the truth. But like, you know, she didn't need to know in person.
Right. So you wrote the book, and then in a lot of media after that, you did. You hosted a Lifetime series where you helped. It was called Monsters in the Family. My wife had watched it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And did you like help connect like victims of killers with the families of the victims and the families of the perpetrators on the show?
Yeah.
How did you get into that?
Okay. So, that happened in about, I think, 2014, which is, gosh, forever ago now. Really, what happened after I came forward with my book, that's what got me, by the way, to backtrack. My daughter asking about that and not really having the answers propelled me to want to find the answers of how do I talk to my child about this? And
right.
So I wrote into the Dr. Phil show thinking he could help me.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about TV.
Right. Yeah.
Well, he knows everything.
Yeah. You can help all these people on TV. Right.
Yeah. He helps all these people. So I wrote into him, into the show, and they're like, so a producer called me right away and said, do you want to go on the show and just get help alone with Dr. Phil, or do you want to go with other people and go to this get real retreat? I was like, be with other people because there's safety in numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I went on the Get Real retreat and not knowing what to expect at all. Like this was the summer. I think I left like Father's Day 2008. Yeah, it was my first time ever even saying out loud the words, because before that, it was just something that I could never even speak of. So I was terrified of telling the world again, you know, about my story, because I had such a negative reaction when he was arrested, just the guilty by association. Then I was afraid I was going to lose my job. I was afraid my husband at the time was going to lose his job, but we banded together, decided this was the right thing, is just to talk about it. But that's when I did that, that's when people started to reach out and say, I'm like you. You know, I have a killer in the family, or, you know, my family member is a victim of crime. And that was the first time in my life where I ever felt connected to other people, because for so long I felt alone. And then now I find out I'm not alone, but it took the courage to step forward and share my story to make that happen.
Truth and Justice is sponsored by First Form. If you were paying attention last week when I was talking about my First Form journey that I'm on right now, and me changing my macros in the First Form app from maintenance to losing weight and set a new goal weight, last week I was at 256 pounds, which is 80 pounds lighter than my original weight, which, by the way, I was 42 years old when I started this journey. But now that I've moved to weight loss mode, dropped my calories, changed my macros, just since last week, 7 days ago when I recorded this, I was 256 pounds. This morning, I'm 253 pounds. That's a 46-year-old man losing 3 pounds in 7 days after already losing 80 pounds. And I'm doing it by eating food that I like, in portions that seem reasonable, in a way that's sustainable, all by being very intentional about my nutrition using the First Form app and supplements. So this is my message for you today, short and sweet. If you are struggling with losing weight, and I'm going to speak from my personal experience, if you're struggling losing weight and you're over 40 years old, don't buy into the bullshit about your metabolism slowing down because you're older or hormonal changes are going to make it so you just can't lose weight. It's not true. You just have to get onto a program that works and is sustainable. It's not designed to be a yo-yo diet. And that plan, that system, those supplements are First Form. That's what's worked for me. That's what's worked for my wife. That's what's worked for Zach's wife and countless other friends of ours that have all gotten onto First Form and all lost incredible amounts of weight in their 40s when they thought they just couldn't do it anymore. So stop listening to the noise, stop making excuses, and get started today. Just go to their website, firstform.com/truth. And they're going to give you free shipping on any order over $75. You can get their greens, their protein powder, their protein bars, protein meat sticks, collagen, energy drinks, anything you need. First Form has it. It tastes good and it's extremely effective. So go to firstform.com/truth. And if your order is over $75, your shipping is free. And if you're a new customer, you've never used First Form before, they're going to email you a link so you can try out the First Form app for free for a month. And from my experience, the app is the key to success with First Form. That's what helps you be mindful and intentional about your nutrition. That's what sets your goals. That's what sets your macros. And again, if you're a new customer and you go to firstform.com/truth, they're going to email you a link to try the app for free for a month. Now's the time to make a difference in your life. Check out First Form now at the number one, STPHORM.com/truth. So can you talk a little bit about from there, besides writing the book where you've finally just kind of released to the world your story, the advocacy work that you've done to help, you know, family members of victims and, like you said, family members of people who have a killer in the family?
Yeah. So from there, I got approached about potentially doing a series, Monster My Family, which we were starting to talk about. And that's when all these other families, I reached out to them and said, do you want to meet with the victims' family members? And they all wanted to, because that's one thing that I also had in common with all these other families is that I had been reached out to by my father's victims' families. And it was a very healing thing for me. And so I wanted to offer that up to other families, and it was healing for them too. So that's how the series got made. And then from there, I started to realize that the media could be a very powerful tool as a connector to bringing people together that have similar stories. So when they came forward, those families on Monster My Family, they too got those letters saying, I'm just like you. Yeah. And then they felt connected. And so I started to really feel that the media could be powerful and as a connector. And then that's when I started to work as a producer in the true crime space. And that's what I feel like my advocacy work is, in that way of helping families tell their story in a way that's meaningful for them.
Yeah, it seems obviously it's not something I can personally relate to, but the family members, when somebody, you know, like your father committed these crimes, like your family becomes like another set of victims. Because, you know, once he's locked away, now you have this stigma on you. And in your case, too, just absolute shock, because you had no idea that, I assume, that your father was even capable of something like that.
Right. Had no idea. No idea. And then it really turned our world upside down. And, you know, I think it's really hard to say we're a victim, because if you say our family is a victim, then it puts us on the same plane as the women that he killed. So I never want to say I'm a victim, because I'm afraid of people thinking that I'm putting myself in that world, in that space, I should say, which I don't see myself as an equal victim, obviously, to the women he killed, or even to the families that he's impacted by killing their loved ones. So I kind of reference myself as like a secondary victim. Because
yeah. Well, I mean, there's
losses, but I just never want to put that comparison out.
Yeah, it's not the same, and that's respectable too. But there's certainly a ripple effect of pain that comes off of anything like this on the victim side and on the perpetrator side.
Absolutely, and it's hard to really even quantify or even talk about what those losses are, because, I mean, I would say that the fear that it instilled in my life was life-changing fear. Like, it froze me in life.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about, so you, a few years after that, you launched your podcast. So it's been out, was it 2018? Happy Face came out?
Yeah, 2018. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You know, 2018 seems like yesterday, and then you start doing the math, like, God dang, that was 7 years ago.
Now, like, if you're like, so I was car shopping for my daughter, and I was like, oh, a 2019 car, that's just like a year old, 2 years old.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
I literally just had this conversation with my wife about my truck I drive as a 2017. And I was like, I feel like there's something going wrong with it. Yeah. Like, maybe it's time to replace it. But I'm like, but it's new. And she's like, new? What are you? It's 8 years old. What are you talking? It's not new. Like, yeah. I feel like the pandemic in the middle of it just like sped time up somehow.
Or erased time in our brain. I don't know. Like,
yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
But Happy Face, the podcast, is still out there. It's really good. I listened to that back when you were putting it out there. There's two seasons, right? There was like 12 episodes in the first season and 10 in the second season.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any plans to revisit that, or is it two seasons and you're done with that?
Two seasons done. I think when that podcast was being created, I was going through a divorce.
Oh, right.
It was not the best timing to do a podcast.
Sure. Yeah. I've been there too.
Yeah. 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 That was a rough time, but I made it through it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I want to talk about, we're recording this ahead of time, but when this episode airs, there'll be four episodes into the new series that is out on Paramount Plus right now called Happy Face, which is what kind of prompted me to reach out to you. And we said, we had talked, I had your number on my phone, and my wife and I were going through and we're like, oh wait, that's Melissa. I remember we met Melissa. And then I thought, well, that we should get her on the show. But now obviously this is a scripted show. It's not a documentary.
It's adapted off of the book Shattered Silence and the podcast. So it took place really, so after the podcast aired, I started getting reached out to by different studios, and I met Jen Casicio, who's the writer and the show creator, and she has her own history with a father that was in jail. And so I just connected with her, and we worked together and she did the primary writing, but I worked with her to consult on it. And that was isn't that seven years ago now? Yeah. Like
that's when it started, the production of this series?
Well, the creation of it. And we went through a writer's strike. We went through change of executives, CBS. Like, so it went through so many different landmines, I guess, that would normally destroy a project, but it survived.
Yeah. Yeah, people don't realize what that I went through that with my docuseries with Octagen. It's like when it aired in 2020.
Okay.
But it was 3 years. It was like the show was bought and we're going to do it. And then same thing, like an executive changes, this changes. And then somebody, you get halfway through it and they want to change something else. And then it's not going to happen. Then it is going to happen. Then it's done and it just sits on the shelf for half a year. It's such a weird business.
It really is. It really is. So like when I got approached from the studios, I already knew basically kind of what you've experienced. I experienced that with Monster, my family. And so there was nothing like, this had to happen. This was like, okay, well, let's do this. And then year after year, you just kind of roll with the punches. I'm like, oh, it's surviving. It's still moving. It's still going forward. This is good. It didn't really feel real until they brought the director, Michael Showalter, on when he signed on. And then after him, then they looked for the lead, who would be my character, who would be Melissa Reed. And they looked at Annalie right off the bat. And then there was like discussions of, well, are we going to film this in Vancouver, BC? Are we going to film this in LA? Which makes a big impact on the show and access to what actors and actresses they get to. And then Dennis Quaid came on last.
Okay.
Well, I was always curious of like, who is going, who's ultimately going to play my father's character?
And right.
That was kind of surprising when they said Dennis Quaid. I'm like, but that's Parent Trap Dad.
Right. But he's so good in it.
He's so good. He's so good. Yeah, he's incredible. I cannot say enough good things about Dennis Quaid as a person and as an actor. But well, I was curious, like, are they going to just try to, portray my father as this brute, that's 6'6" and it's going to be about his physical dominance? But because for me, it wasn't his physical dominance that I struggled with or was intimidated by. It was the manipulation. Like, he manipulated my heart, my trust. He betrayed my trust over and over again. And Dennis picked up on it right away. Like, he read the script. He knew instantly how to do this cat and mouse with Annalie. And watching him, it was surreal.
Annalie, Christy in our chat mentioned this, but I was going to mention it too. Like, Annalie Ashford looks so much like you that when I saw like the trailers and the cover for it, I thought it was you for I mean, you know, I'd only met you in person the one time. Yeah. I'm like, wait, is that, that's not Melissa. She's not an actress, but is it? Like, it was such a good casting.
Yeah.
For a lot more reasons than just that, but
right.
One of them.
Right. But that's what people say to me all the time. Like, we were together, Annalie and I were together at South by Southwest, and people are like, you guys could be sisters. I was like, yeah, I guess, yeah, we probably could. But I love that she really, you know, I didn't talk to her before she started, you know, doing her research to get into the role. She listened to the podcast, but we didn't talk before. She just leaned in on the writing, and that's how she developed her portrayal of me, I guess.
Are you happy with the portrayal of you?
Yeah, I think it's really kind. I mean, you never know when, you know, yeah. Like, you don't know how people perceive you, or like, everybody has their own quirks and flaws. So I was curious how she was going to portray my flaws and my own quirks, and, or, you know, what would she pick up on about me as a person that she would latch onto? You know, you never know what that would be.
I know you're listed as an executive producer, and you said you're a consultant. How much involvement have you had? I mean, obviously, it sounds like you've met, spent some time with Dennis Quaid, which is crazy. I mean, let me back that. What if you jump back to, say, 2008? Mm-hmm. Could you imagine a situation where you're sitting talking with Dennis Quaid about starring in a movie about your life?
No, and actually, when I was sitting with him for dinner one night, I don't know how it came up, but I said something about, I always saw my dad as the National Lampoon's Christmas Story, the Uncle Eddie. Uncle Eddie to me was always my dad. And I said that to Dennis Quaid, and he goes, that's my brother.
I said, that's Randy Quaid.
Like, you're pulling my leg. What? He's like, yes, that's my brother. I'm like, oh,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, I'm really not starstruck or like any, you know, into celebrities and their lives. So I knew nothing about the fact that he was married to Meg Ryan, or like no idea about the incredible women that have been in his life. I knew nothing about his life. In fact, I actually said something to him, and I'm embarrassed to say this. I was like, you know, you have a great voice. Have you ever thought about like voiceovering a documentary? And like, he's like, I just did that. Good deal. Like, I'm like, okay, sorry. Then I was joking. I'm like, you should be an actor.
Right. I promise you, my audience, when they hear this, will be laughing right now, because they've heard all of my, you and I are kindred spirits, because I'm the same way. I have no idea. But I always tell a story about the time that I big leagued Idris Elba when I was doing a speaking event in London.
Okay.
And some guy came out, we were going to some pub like for like a meet and greet afterward, and some guy came out and he's like, hey, Idris Elba's here and he wants to meet you.
Who this is, by the way?
Me neither. This was 2 weeks after he was crowned as People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive. He had a huge hit show, Luther. He was on The Office. He's been on a million things. He's like super famous, and I'm like, I don't do well with crowds, and they were like taking me into this packed pub full of people. And so I'm already like super anxious. And in some back room, they had people waiting to go take like pictures with me. And as I'm going back through and I see this huge line of people, and all I want to do is get out of there. And then they bring this guy over to me, Idris Elba. And he's like, hey, nice to meet you. I shake his hand, and he's like, you want to get a picture? And I said, yeah, but I'll definitely take a picture with you, but I've already got people waiting in line. So let me get in with them, and then I'll come back and I'll get you in a minute. Guess what? Never happened.
The picture never happened.
Never happened. He wasn't super into it after that for whatever reason. Yeah, same thing.
Okay, okay. Love to hear this. I'm glad we're kindred spirits. Yeah.
Oh, I have stories a mile long doing the same stupid shit when I was doing mine. I almost, John Cryer produced my docuseries. I almost blew him off because I was like emailing, he was like, as though he was just a fan of my podcast about a case I was working on. And then he's like, hey, man, here's my phone number. Give me a call. I want to talk to you about a project. And I was like, okay. And I turned to my wife and I was like, who does this? Like, I'm not giving this guy my number. She's like, who? Let me read it. And she's like, is that the John Cryer? I'm like, who's John Cryer? Like, I had no, she's like, Ducky, you know, Two and a Half Men. And then I was like, oh, whoops. So I almost blew him off too. So you're not alone by not knowing that Randy Quaid has voiced over documentaries and that stuff. How I want to know, because I'm always surprised whenever I meet somebody that is an actor. Everyone I've met that I thought was huge is tiny. How tall? Because your dad was a big guy.
Yeah, 6'6". Yeah.
Yeah. How tall is Dennis Quaid?
I think 6 foot at least.
But he's not super
tall. He's not short. Yeah, and he's taller than me. I'm 5'5". So I want to say, like, he's at least, like, 5'9", 6 foot, at least. He's pretty ripped.
Is he?
Yeah. It's like, he has his dog named Peaches that follows him everywhere. And Peaches is incredible. She's so well-mannered, but he showed me some videos of some behind the scenes of where he's practicing with the inmates in the yard for the scenes when he's playing my father, and he gets attacked by one of the inmates. And so he's fighting this inmate in the scene, and Peaches runs out and starts humping the inmate's leg.
Know who else has a dog I found out by accident that always is unseen is Mark Harmon. Have you ever seen NCIS? Do you know who Mark Harmon is?
No.
You're just making me so happy that you also don't know who these people
are. I don't know who these people are. But
well, John was, is it summer camp or summer school he was in from like back in our day? But anyway, he was the lead in NCIS, and John Cryer was working as a repeating regular on that show. And I had a meeting with John at the set, and Mark Harmon has a dog. It's a big golden retriever that follows him every day. Like, he'd go out to his trailer when they take a break. When they come out to shoot, he'd come out. His dog would lay down on the floor. The dog is laying there for every scene. For all of you listening, any scene you've ever seen of NCIS, Mark Harmon's dog is just above the camera line, just laying there all the time. But I didn't get to see him hump anybody.
Okay. That was really funny to see Peaches humping an inmate's leg as actor inmate leg. And then he went off to the inmate bed that was supposed to be my father's cell, you know? Uh-huh. So it's kind of funny to see Peaches is laying in this like metal cell room.
Right.
So it's supposed to be a prison. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you've had a great experience. It sounds like the actors that you're working with have been awesome. It sounds like you were been on set with them while they're filming it. Like, how actively were you involved in the process?
Well, I flew out to Vancouver, BC to do the cameo for episode one, where I pretty much hand the torch to Melissa by saying, hi, Melissa, you know, in the hallway. Yeah. So it's kind of fun to say hi to yourself, you know, like, hi, you know, passing the torch of telling the story, I guess.
I don't know if I even caught that.
You didn't? Okay.
But I watch it. And so I've seen the first two episodes. I haven't seen episode three just aired last night for me right now.
It's episode one when she's at the Dr. Greg show and she's walking down the hall and I say, hi, Melissa. And she says, hi, back.
That's fun. That's great.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So it was an incredible amount of people that worked on set. I mean, it took over, I would say, like a fairground type of area, you know, with all the trailers and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty incredible the amount of crew that worked. And they worked on it all last summer. I mean, 13-hour days. And they're living in a hotel all summer. Yeah. Pretty incredible what actors do, you know?
Yeah. It's a rough life. I had just, not as an actor, but I just had the little taste of it when I did the docuseries. And it was like, I've had other offers to do other show, like true crime documentary shows or host them. And I'm just like, it's not for me. This is too much. Like,
I know.
The travel and the hours and everything is terrible.
It's really a lot of work. And for them, they had to memorize their lines. I could never memorize lines.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
No way.
I mean, I had to practice saying, hi, Melissa, my one line. It's like, what if they how do I say it? Do I say it like happy? Do I say it? What's the inflection?
In your one line, how hard is it, right?
Well, you know, like when you take family pictures and you're like, what do I do with my hands?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. It's just not a natural thing. So you're like, what, you know, you overthink it is what I guess I'm trying to say is I just overthink
right. it. Yeah. That's why actors are actors and we are yep. not.
Yes, exactly.
Well, it's awesome. I can't wait to see more of it. Like I said, I've seen the first two episodes now. Those of you that when you're listening to this, Happy Face on Paramount Plus, there'll be four episodes out and it's an 8-part series, right? There's four right. more episodes coming.
Yeah. And episode four is my favorite episode.
Oh, fantastic. So that's yeah. coming out. That'll be out the Thursday before you guys hear this. So it airs on Thursdays. Guys, check out Happy Face. And Melissa, thanks so much for joining me. It was great catching up with you.
Yeah, this is fun. Thanks for having me on.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.